their homes and relocate in distant areas from the capital. In the light of this unfortunate event, one of the major achievements of Imam Kazım was the creation of a functional and wide networks of deputies across the world. Harun was one of the most infamous rulers from the Abbasid dynasty, whose oppressive policies against the Shia Muslims, and specifically Imam Kazım, were formidable. In most of the reign of this Abbasid ruler, Imam Kazım spent long years in prison. Being descended from the line of the Holy Prophet, the Abbasid ruler Harun always wanted to be considered a direct descendant of the Holy Prophet like Imam Kazım. In fact, he intended to win the trust of the public by his connection to the Islamic Prophet. Once, when Harun was visiting the gravesite of the Holy Prophet, he called out to the Prophet saying, "Peace be to you, O Kazım." In this moment, Imam Kazım faced the grave of the Prophet and said, "Peace be upon you, O Father." Imam Kazım had many sons, most of whom fled away due to the threats of the Abbasid Caliphate. Today, there are many shrines related to the children and descendants of Imam Kazım across the different Islamic territories. The daughter of Imam Kazım, Lady Masuma, started a journey to meet her beloved brother Imam Reza in Iran. However, she departed this world due to the hardships she went through in the way. Today, her shrine is a place of great pilgrimage to the large number of Shias and the Prophet's household's lovers. The popularity of Imam Kazım in Medina was never tolerated by Harun. Therefore, the Abbasid ruler forced Imam Kazım to leave Medina and move to Baghdad. In a short time, Imam Kazım received the public acceptance in Baghdad, and the people regarded his holiness as the embodiment of virtue and spirituality. The public acceptance of Imam Kazım was never tolerable to the Abbasid ruler. For that reason, in 179 after Hijra, Harun poisoned Imam Kazım in the cold and dark dungeons. In this period, Harun used all means to torture and hurt Imam Kazım. In 183 after Hijra, Imam Kazım was poisoned by Harun. Finally, the seventh Shia leader was martyred at the age of 55. The thin and lifeless body of Imam Kazım was left on the bridge of Baghdad, where the people left flowers on his body. According to history, there was a big heap of flowers on the body of Imam Kazım.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for tuning back into Light Upon Light. We left off with our beloved Sheikh Muhammad talking about the agency that Imam Kazım alayhi salam builds with his Shia or his followers. And one of the main examples was Ali ibn Yaqtin. Ali ibn Yaqtin, of course, the famous narrator and companion of Imam Kazım alayhi salam and Imam Sadiq. And he was put in as an inside man to benefit the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam inside the government of the Abbasid Khalifa. And I think that's where we left off, that he didn't want to, and that the Imam said that there were benefits of you being there.
There are more benefits that you don't know. And when Imam talked to Ali ibn Yaqtin, he started to understand and stayed there. What were the tasks of Ali ibn Yaqtin? For example, one of them, to bring information, inside information to Imam, alayhi salam. Now, saying this, this question might pop up for some people, that Imam, alayhi salam, knows everything. Imam doesn't need a person to bring him information about the government of, for example, Harun. But studying the knowledge of Ahlul Bayt from the narrations and from trusted books like Kafi, for example, Wasa'il al-Shia, we understand that Imam alayhi salam knows everything when he wants to know. Sometimes Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, they want things to happen in their natural ways.
Right. Or they were ordered to follow the natural causes and reasons. They know what's going to happen, but they were ordered to follow the natural consequences, the natural things that happen.
Yes, they want the natural thing to happen. And for example, so many times in the history when we study, we understand that Ahlul Bayt, for example, they ask a question, although they know the answer, but they ask because they want the person to answer. Probably some people are hearing. They want, they want more things and purposes. They have different aims that we don't have. So Imam alayhi salam put Ali ibn Yaqtin brought information from within the government of Harun, and that helped in many instances the Imam and the Shia, because the Harun wanted to was very treacherous and was very conspirator, right? A person who conspirated a lot, in the back of Shia and Ahlul Bayt to either kill them, imprison them, hurt them in so many ways. And this helped Imam alayhi salam and Shia so much. The other thing was that Ali ibn Yaqin was the minister of Harun. So he got to a very high rank, right? The first minister. And so he had power. He sent Shia to Hajj, for example. And different tasks, through these different tasks, Ali ibn Yaqin helped the Shia so much financially. For example, he sent, for example, this year, 10 men to Hajj. And by going to Hajj, he gave them so much more money that they normally would be given, right? Different financial aid by kind of fake titles. Mm-hmm. For example, you have to go Hajj on behalf of the government, for example, right? They went to Hajj for themselves. They received a lot of money.
See, what you're saying, a huge question pops up to my mind. Isn't that cheating? Or you could say, for example, treason. I'm not going to say treason, but isn't that cheating for personal gains?
At first sight, it might seem that Ali ibn Yaqin, being the minister, should always obey the commands of the Harun, for example, which is the king. But when you pay attention to the fact that the real rule is for Imam Qasim alayhi salam.
So the Abbasid Khalifas and before them the Muawiyas were fake.
They are fake. They oppressively have taken this position which is rightfully for Imam alayhi salam. So Imam alayhi salam's command is important to be obeyed because he is the king, right? He is the leader. They are not the leaders. So Imam alayhi salam says that for the benefit of the Shia, for the things that I advise, we should do a couple of things. One of those things is to help the Shia. Why to help the Shia? Because in the time of Harun and other rulers of Bani Abbas, they were so much oppressed. They became so poor. They had very difficult lives. Now, who is going to help them? Their imam is the leader, is the person that they rely on, right? Is the person that God has put for us to rely on, to trust, to seek help from. So Imam alayhi salam put Ali ibn Yaqin into that position to help the Shia. The next example in terms of monetary help is in terms of taxes. So, you know, the rulers of Abbasid, they took, you know, high taxes from people, especially Shia. And that was not right because, you know, receiving tax is not right by the decision of Imam. So Ali ibn Yaqin did something very interesting, and that's the fact that he received taxes from the Shia and secretively gave them back to them.
Return taxes.
Yes, return them. So this was these are a couple of important actions that Ali ibn Yaqin did on behalf of Imam alayhi salam.
So that was the agency of Imam Qadim alayhi salam in portrayal by Ali ibn Yaqin.
Yes.
Sheikh, thank you very much for these beautiful words. But for now, until the next show, brothers and sisters, unfortunately our time has finished. We would like to congratulate all the Shias around the world for these days of the remembrance of the birthday of Imam Al-Kadhim alayhi salam, our seventh Imam. From now until another light upon light, please join us again. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Reporters.
Palestinians accused Israel of using unjustified deadly force against Palestinian children in the occupied West Bank
in its latest report, Defense for Children International Palestine stated that the Israeli soldiers continue to kill Palestinian children with no recourse or accountability. In its report, DCI Palestine revealed that evidence it has obtained shows children killed didn't pose any threat to the Israeli soldiers at the time of their killing. The group says that Israeli forces used lethal force against Palestinian children in circumstances that may amount to extrajudicial or willful killings.
Killing unarmed minors amounts to war crime and even crime against humanity. Israeli soldiers act in line with shoot-to-kill policy, opening fire to kill Palestinian children. The troopers know their military establishment will hold any of them accountable for killing innocent Palestinians.
On Friday, a 17-year-old Palestinian boy, Mohammed Tamimi, was fatally shot by live ammunition in his back during a peaceful anti-settlement protest that was held in Nabi Saleh town, West Ramallah. Meanwhile, on Monday, a 17-year-old Yusuf Nawaf Mhareb, a resident of the Ramallah area village of Abwin, succumbed to wounds he had sustained a prayer when he was shot in the neck by Israeli forces during a protest against Israel's aggression on the Gaza Strip. Experts say that under international law, the use of lethal force during a protest is allowed only when a direct and lethal threat to life or of serious injury exists. And as usual, Israel continues violating international law, including rules which limit the intentional lethal use of firearms, in particular against children.
Israeli forces have a twofold purpose by targeting Palestinian children. First, they want to intimidate Palestinian children to prevent them from taking part in anti-Israeli activity, and second, to oppress the Palestinians in general, to impose and strengthen the Israeli military control.
Since the beginning of the year, 10 Palestinian minors were killed in the occupied West Bank by Israeli forces using live ammunition. Palestinians accuse Israel of using unjustified force against their children. They even warn that Israeli soldiers will continue killing children in cold blood as long as they won't face inquiry. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Speaker of Iran's parliament, Mohammad Baqir Qalibov, has met Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. Assad said that Iran is a main partner for Syria, which offered its support in all sectors. He asserted that ongoing coordination for fighting terror had a positive impact on the ground and will continue until the liberation of all Syrian territories. Qalibov said the Syrian and Iranian people's determination to participate in the recent presidential elections in the two countries proves the failure of policies of pressure adopted by their enemies. Qalibov held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart, Hamoud Sabbagh. He said military and political relations with Syria are currently in their strongest and best form, expressing willingness to enhance economic cooperation with Syria.
After their failure in military war against Iran, the Zionist and U.S. regimes have waged an economic war against us. Our joint priority now is to achieve development in our countries, improve our economy, restore the infrastructure, and increase the bulk of mutual trade exchange.
Sabbagh referred to the high level of coordination between parliaments of Iran and Syria, affirming that the two countries stand together in the resistance alliance, working to eliminate hegemony and colonialism which their enemies are imposing on the region.
We held a very special and important meeting for further coordination between both parliaments through consultations and the exchange of expertise. We also agreed on activating the work of our friendship committees in the two parliaments for the benefit of the two peoples.
Speaker Qalibov also held talks with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. They underlined the importance of expansion of economic cooperation in both public and private sectors for facing economic sanctions, as well as the siege imposed on the Iranian and Syrian people.
The exchange of visits between Iranian and Syrian officials reflects the strong historic ties between the two countries. There has been a noticeable development in economic, political, military, and parliamentary cooperation since the start of the war on Syria, which represents an alliance both states are strengthening to counter U.S. and Western pressure against them. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki and his wife.
Addressing the press, a member of Zazaki's defense team said the Kaduna State High Court discharged and acquitted Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat of all 8 charges in a ruling that lasted for several hours. The judge ruled that the prosecution has failed to establish any case against the leader of the Islamic movement in Nigeria and his wife.
The court ruled that the charge ought not to be in the first place. You cannot arraign a man for an offense that was allegedly committed, as at the time the said crime was not an offense. And the court was very emphatic in that yes, the Kaduna State government has powers to enact laws, but it cannot enact laws to prosecute an offense retrospectively.
Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat were arrested in December 2015 following an attack on his home and worship center by soldiers of the Nigerian army, which resulted in the killing of hundreds of Zazaki's supporters. In a statement, the Islamic movement said the judgment is a vindication of Sheikh Zazaki and a victory for truth and justice against tyranny and oppression.
The events of December 12th and 15th of 2015 were orchestrated by state machineries who are using the instrumentalities of state apparatus to fight a religious fight. It is strictly, the events of December 12, 2015, is strictly a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, fights that was imported from Saudi Arabia for whatever purpose.
The Kaduna State High Court has set Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat free. The Islamic movement, and indeed many of Zazaki's supporters, have expressed happiness with the outcome of this judgment. Anjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
Three 3,000 of Ethiopian refugees crossed the Sudanese borders on Monday, arriving at Taya village at Basunda locality in Gadarif state. Reports say the refugees is considered the biggest number of refugees to cross into the country in only one day since the outbreak of war last November in Tigray region. Many believe that the wave may worsen security and humanitarian situation in the region due to armed conflicts erupting at western area of Ethiopia.
Sudan has adopted an open-door policy in receiving Ethiopian refugees since the beginning of the conflict. So far, Sudan has welcomed about 75,000 to 80,000 refugees. We call on the international community to help us meet the needs of the increasing refugees fleeing from the fight in the Tigray region.
Since the beginning of fighting, tens of thousands of Ethiopians have sought safety in Sudan. But conditions in Sudan refugee camps are presenting a new challenges, as Sudanese NGOs early responded to humanitarian situation in states affected of refugees influx.
Actually, since the crisis of the refugees started, the Tigray crisis started, Sudanese Red Crescent has been present from day one. And that is basically because we do have our ongoing activities in the region through our branches in Kassala and Gadarif. So we do have ongoing programs for the already existed old refugees in the area. So with the beginning of the crisis, we were already on the ground.
In the light of the latest development in the Tigray region, UN agencies strive to maintain a strong staff presence, provided there is access in Hamadayet in case there is an increased influx. Several partners continue to remain on the ground in anticipation of this possibility.
Security and health challenges face Sudanese and Ethiopian governments to cope with increasing number of refugees. Khartoum says it is still waiting for international support to tackle the crisis. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
An Algerian judoka athlete who made headlines last week for shunning an Israeli opponent at the Tokyo Olympics has now been temporarily suspended along with his coach from the International Judo Federation, meaning that Fethi Nurin will not be able to compete after making his bold statement in support of Palestine. After returning to Algeria, V secured an exclusive interview with Noreen to ask why he felt he had to walk.
I was pitted to play against an athlete from the usurper entity occupying Palestinian land, a regime which kills innocent people and drives them out of their homes, day and night. Because of this, I don't accept that my hand is smeared with someone who represents an entity like this, and for his flag to be associated with the Algerian flag, which is in support of the Palestinians' cause.
His actions meant he would miss out on a chance to win a medal, but Noreen admitted he had no regrets.
If the same situation arises, I would not hesitate to take the same decision. The world needs to know that Israel is an occupier and they practice all kinds of laws that deviate from the international laws and human rights. We need to send a message to the world that we deal with all religions with dignity, just as the Islamic religion recommended us to do, except for the ones who fight against the religion and the Muslims. We are against them and it's our rights to respond to them. We have the right to defend our religion and all oppressed Muslims.
The Olympic Charter takes a strong stance against any political acts, stating that no kind of demonstration or political, religious or racial propaganda is permitted.
However, this isn't the first time that a Muslim athlete has protested against this controversial lineup. Many are now starting to ask questions about the Olympics and their lack of sensitivity on the subject. Also, are the games being used to whitewash Israel at a time when Palestinians remain deeply oppressed? Robert Carter, London.
More and more people in the EU are congregating indoors. The highly contagious Delta variant of COVID-19 is spreading like wildfire in countries like France and Spain. More people are also travelling within the EU. Citizens in Brussels have been sharing their thoughts on the Delta variant.
I don't know where the cases come from, if it's a coffee restaurant or just meeting in our house.
When I see how people are behaving sometimes, I'm not surprised.
The European Central Bank, which manages the euro, says economic confidence is being undermined.
The pandemic continues to cast a shadow, especially as the Delta variant constitutes a growing source of uncertainty.
On Monday, EU finance ministers rubber-stamped COVID-19 recovery funding for four additional nations in the 27-country bloc.
Croatia, Cyprus, Lithuania and Slovenia. Now more than half of national plans is adopted.
However, critics say the billions of euro being administered to national governments will result in citizens being saddled with decades more austerity because there is too much emphasis on loans rather than grants. According to analysts, EU leaders are harming the bloc's economy through their foreign policy. Sanctions are inhibiting trade. Economists say the Iranian market represents a big opportunity. It can be availed of if current efforts to save the JCPOA Iran nuclear deal succeed. We have been speaking to the head of the European Parliament's Iran delegation about the subject via Skype. She believes the agreement will be reinstated soon.
Many people in Iran say, again and again and again, we have not a good partner on this side. This is one of the impacts of this horrible, stupid policy of Trump.
The International Labour Organization, ILO, warns an additional 25 million jobs could be lost globally before the end of this year due to the coronavirus. However, the ILO says if we see an internationally coordinated policy response, the number of people losing their jobs could be much lower. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people and the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Aoun on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new. No baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
The British government has decided to expand blanket stop and search powers under a new plan to beat crime. Measures unveiled on Tuesday include changes to police powers to allow searching people without suspicion in areas where they believe violence could break out under the Section 60 Criminal Justice and Public Order Act.
Across all stop and searches powers, black people are 9 times more likely to be stopped than white people. But under the Section 60 Act, that rate is even higher at a whopping 18 times. Moreover, the research data shows that in 99% of Section 60 searches, no weapon is found.
Press TV got a reaction to this story from Charles Critchlow, former president of the National Black Police Association. He said,
"This government has abandoned any pretense of a desire for a fair and just society, particularly insofar as black people are concerned. First of all, the efficacy of such an approach is not proven. Moreover, it's counterproductive in that it alienates the community when the support of the community is critical."
His thoughts were echoed by Suleiman Lee, a community activist from Black Child Promotions, who himself has been harassed by the police.
There's always going to be conflict at street level. There's disorganized crime, then there's organized crime. And as I said before, black youth cannot facilitate any criminal underworld. They can only participate. A lot of black youth, they're serving time, even though we're 3% of the population, according to the 2011 census, we're disproportionately represented in the prisons at Her Majesty's pleasure.
The government announcement came 2 months after the Criminal Justice Alliance, a network of 160 organisations, called for the power to be repealed, arguing that Section 60 had led to thousands of innocent people being unnecessarily stopped and searched every year, with the number of searches rising from 622 in 2016 to 2017 to more than 18,000 in 2019 to 2020. It seems unlikely that Priti Patel will bow to pressure from campaigners, after already dismissing the criticisms levied against the plans, much like she dismissed the sentiments behind the Black Lives Matter protests that swept throughout the UK. Ahmed Cabello, London.
On On the occasion of the Eid al-Ghadir, Iran has officially begun vaccinating prisoners across the nation against the COVID-19 virus. Speaking at the vaccination ceremony, Iran's deputy health minister said that in view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days.
In view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days. Thanks to the proper observation of health protocols by prisoners, the average number of people infected with the virus in prisons has been less than ordinary people.
In the past couple of days, with the imports of foreign-made vaccines and the entry of domestically produced vaccines into the vaccination basket of the country, the pace of vaccination process has increased to the extent that, according to the Iranian health minister, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
In the occasion of the auspicious Eid al-Ghadir, we have begun vaccinating all prisoners across the country. To vaccinate all prisoners and those working at prisons, we need over 200,000 doses of vaccines. This amount has already been supplied, and the vaccination process for prisoners will continue as planned. At today's ceremony at Evin Prison, in Tehran, 250 prisoners were among the first to receive the jabs.
Moreover, centers for drive-in vaccination across the country have been established, and they have played a major role in the increase in the daily vaccination rate. Iran is using a combination of locally produced vaccines and imported foreign-made vaccines in its national vaccination program. According to Iranian health officials, the country's homemade coronavirus vaccines develop immunity against the new mutations of the virus. According to Iran's health ministry, almost 60 million Iranians will be vaccinated against the virus by the end of the current Iranian year in March 2022, using domestically produced and foreign-made vaccines. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allah wa la ilaha illa
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirru Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. Some discipline and secrets of takbirs and the eradication of hands. There is a reference to some of what has been said in a lengthy tradition, quoting Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq, peace be upon him, describing the ascending. He said, Allah the Glorified and Almighty sent down to the Prophet a carriage of light comprised of 40 sorts of light which were around the heaven. But about the holy man's prayer, as it was said before, it is the manifestation of reflection. Thus, when make their own pure heart the scene of the individual world, and they focus their own heart's mirror upon the real sun for the sake of their heart, behalf of invisible stage and special manifestation will be occurred to them. And when at the first manifestation is restrictive, they call a takbir, then they consider it as the veil's light and divert their heart from it, and through their hands show the eradication of the heart's veil.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. Imam Khomeini has said that those who have malicious view of Islam are those who have no understanding of Islam. This is a general problem that we see in today's world, and it was before as well, that this Islamophobia, which is spread and it's increasing day by day,
For example, the French minister comes and he talks about Islam in a bad way, and he portrays Islam as the religion of terrorists. And the other people were talking about Islam, the Zionist regime on the other hand, and these people, all of them who were talking about Islam, and they're giving their malicious views about Islam, these are because they never understand Islam. Either they never understand Islam, or they know Islam very well, but obviously they are the followers of the evil. That's what we can say. Because Islam, which is the religion of peace, I can give you many examples. These examples are written in the history as well. History has basically noted all these examples. For example, when the Prophet ﷺ had the victory of Mecca, that was a time where all the enemies who were the polytheists, mushrikeen, and the kuffar who were in the Mecca, they were all present in the Mecca. Those who shed the blood of these Muslims, those who have occupied the houses and the wealth of these Muslims, who robbed them and who basically kicked these Muslims out of Mecca at the time when they were weak. They were all there. But when Prophet went to the Mecca, even his enemies, they're also safe and no one will hurt them. And this is my wordings. Islam is a religion of peace. Islam calls towards the intellect.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say la ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The knock on the door came at 3 PM as smoke was filling the sky. When Christina Bowen heard the Plumas County Sheriff's deputy shouting, she knew she had to move fast. He said, point blank, pack your family's bags, you've got 5 minutes to get out, said Miss Bowen, a 40-year-old, recalling the scramble to evacuate from her mobile home as the Dixie Fire by far the largest blaze now raging in California, swept through surrounding forests. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Simon Romero and Annie Carney. The piece is titled, "This Isn't How We're Supposed to Live. Residents Flee as Dixie Fire Surges." Knock on the door came at 3 p.m. as smoke was filling the sky when Christina Bowen heard the Plumas County Sheriff's deputy shouting. She knew she had to move fast. He said point blank, "Pack your family's bags. You've got 5 minutes to get out," said Miss Bowen, a 40-year-old, recalling the scramble to evacuate her mobile home as the Dixie Fire, by far the largest blaze now raging in California, swept through surrounding forests. In what has grown into a grim ritual in this part of Northern California, at least 16,500 people have had to recently flee their homes as yet another colossal wildfire balloons in size. The evacuations are raising tensions in a region still recovering from the Camp Fire, which left 85 people dead in 2018 and is the deadliest wildfire in California's history. President Joe Biden met virtually on Friday, 30th of July, with governors from seven western states, where devastating wildfires have grown more severe in recent years as climate change leads to hotter and drier landscape. They discussed how the federal government could help states with prevention, preparedness, and emergency response efforts. More than 80 large wildfires were burning across the country on Friday, 30th of July, scorching about 1.7 million acres across 13 states. The two largest wildfires, the Dixie Fire, which has spread to nearly 241,000 acres of land, and the Bootleg Fire in southern Oregon, have both been described by fire officials as burning earlier and more intensely than is usual for this time of the year because of drought conditions and record heat across the region. In an eerie echo of the campfire which destroyed the town of Paradise and was started by equipment from the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, the utility giant told regulators this month that its equipment might have also started the Dixie Fire in the same mountainous canyon where the 2018 wildfire began. The cause of the Dixie Fire remains under investigation. Lindsay Paolo, a Pacific Gas and Electric Company spokeswoman, declined to respond to questions, instead referring to a report filed with regulators and a court filing in response to a court order that requested information on the blaze. The incident report, which the company filed on 18th of July, described how an employee observed blown fuses in terrain off Highway 70 and a fire underground near the base of the tree, which he reported to his supervisor, who then called 911. In the July 28th court filing, the company said it was continuing to investigate the role of its equipment in the Dixie Fire, which on Friday, 30th of July, was about 23% contained. As firefighters struggled to contain the blaze, Quincy, on the edge of the evacuation zone, was transformed this week from a sleepy logging town of about 2,000 residents into a frenetic staging area. At night, firefighting crews pitch tents and sleep in the town's park. At daybreak, they pile into trucks and bulldozers and head into the surrounding mountains. In one of the largest emergency mobilizations underway in the United States, at least 6,079 personnel have been called up to fight the Dixie Fire. They face an array of vexing conditions during 24-hour shifts, including hiking more than 15 miles through rough mountainous terrain to reach places where engines are simply unable to advance. Black Hawk helicopters whirling overhead carrying National Guard soldiers with water to drop over the blaze, give parts of the area the feel of a war zone. Getting to Quincy from the city of Chico involves passing through multiple roadblocks and deserted Gold Rush-era outposts like Twain and Belden, which were somehow saved by firefighters. Charred trees still stand alongside much of Highway 70, as well as signs of close calls such as burnt automobiles in front of intact but empty homes. Some forested hillsides remained smoldering on Friday. Multiple signs on the road expressed gratitude for the firefighters deployed against the Dixie Fire. "I'm just glad to be alive," said Marva Stewart, a 75-year-old, a retired sales clerk who has spent the last week and a half in a makeshift shelter at the Spring of Hope Church in Quincy, California. "But it's frustrating not having any idea when this will end. This isn't how we're supposed to live in this country." On one afternoon this week, some in the cramped church scrolled through social media feeds on their phones for updates on the Dixie Fire, which started on 13th of July and has consumed an area larger than New York City. Baltazar Garcia tried many times to call his sister, but swamped mobile phone networks in Quincy meant he could not get through. "This has been really hard on me," Mr. Garcia, a 76-year-old, a former quarry worker, said in Spanish. "I'm alone here, and it's difficult to even find out what's going on. At least they're giving us meals." Other evacuees spent time in the parking lot of a semblance of privacy or sought refuge in their cars, turning up the air conditioning as the smoke turned the sky an unusual shade of orange. Every so often, they turned on the wipers to clean the ash settling on their windshields. "I can't take it anymore," said Tracy Ketchum, a 66-year-old, a retired homemaker, as she sat in her car outside the church. She said she was looking for some peace and quiet when she left Orange County in Southern California for the rural enclave of Greenville 9 years ago. "I study the Bible. Now I can't help but feel this is the end of days," Miss Ketchum said. The lack of privacy in the shelter, she said, coupled with reports that of Pacific Gas and Electric's involvement and the absence of reliable information as to how long this disaster could last, had her feeling at wit's end. "Maybe it's all a sign that I should just go home, no matter the risk," said Miss Ketchum, who lived alone. "All the waiting, the kids crying, the damn heat right here in town, it's got to be better than it is right here." As if pointing to the drought conditions nurturing wildfires in much of the West, temperatures have hovered around 100 degrees Fahrenheit this week in the areas around Dixie Fire. The wildfire has grown so much that in Sacramento, the state capital, that is 3-hour drive from Quincy, smoke from Dixie Fire raised concerns this week over worsening air quality. Authorities urged Sacramento residents with respiratory problems or heart disease to limit outdoor exposure. "It feels like we're swept up in something we cannot control," said Scott Ludwig, who evacuated from the mobile home park with Ms. Bowen and their 2 children. Mr. Ludwig, a former carnival worker who now gets by on disability payments, said he wanted answers from Pacific Gas and Electric Company. "It's insulting that we still have to pay an electricity bill to a company that doesn't learn from its own mistakes." Putting out a cigarette as he stood near the shelter's entrance, he gazed at the thousands of logs piled high nearby, a reminder of how much Quincy relies on the trees now going up in flames. "We have no idea if we'll have to evacuate again," Mr. Ludwig said. "Look around us. There's lots to burn. If the wildfire reaches this place, we're nothing but roasted ducks."
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. So welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we have a nice story at the first step. The title of this story is Lesson from the Hedgehog's Teamwork. It was the coldest winter ever. Many animals died because of the cold. The hedgehogs, realizing the situation, decided to group together to keep warm. This way they covered and protected themselves. But the quills of each one wounded their closest companions. After a while, they decided to distance themselves one from the other, and they began to die, alone and frozen. So they had to make a choice, either accept the quills of the companions or disappear from the earth. Wisely, they decided to go back to begin together. They learned to live with the little wounds caused by the close relationship with their companions in order to receive the heat that came from the others. This way, they were able to survive. The moral point of this story can be like this. The best relationship is not the one that brings together perfect people. But when each individual learns to live with the imperfections of others and can admire the other person's good qualities.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi-nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to talk about teamwork in Islam. We know that all religions are social institutions, and as mankind and human communities are all common collections of human beings, we understand that in all religions, emphasis is put on social activities in one way or another. At the same time, we find that when people come to think about teamwork, they usually collaborate with each other. Imagine that, for example, a building would be built by one single individual, or in contrast, several people would collaborate. I mean, each person, with a special kind of speciality. The result would certainly be very much different. One would be a mega construct, and another one is an acceptable place for living. We find that in teamwork, I mean, the idea of teamwork is highly elaborated in Islam, and from this perspective, it can be understood that in teamwork, everybody feels that they work both for themselves and for the community to which they belong, such that one may learn from other people, other members of the same community or team of, collaborators. Now we find that in the Holy Quran, as the intact word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it's indicated that there must be some people, I mean, some group of believers who would invite other people to doing good and detest committing the forbidden deeds. And that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran indicates that those people who invite other people to doing good and to detest committing the evil, these people, I mean, these inviters would be those people who would reach felicity. This notion is indicated in the Surah Ali Imran, in the Holy Quran, in the Surah Ali Imran. Elsewhere, we find that in the Holy Quran, a kind of integrity, I mean, faith-based integrity or religion-based integrity is highlighted. In the Surah Ashura, it's indicated that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala indicates that he has determined for us whatever he had instructed the community or the followers of the Prophet Noah, and then whatever he revealed it to the prophets Abraham, Moses, and Jesus Christ. And the purpose is that they would establish the religion, the divine religion, and in the case of the Islamic religion, the Islamic, and in the case of Islam, the Islamic religion. And by doing so, this community of believers wouldn't be shattered and wouldn't be dispersed. So we find that in it, I mean, the communal view of believing in religion is highlighted. At the same time, we find that the sixth infallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam indicated that there wouldn't be any small community of four believers, just four believers, who would pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for fulfilling a desire unless Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala accepts the prayers and fulfills the desires. Now we find that in this connection, it must be indicated that next to the social aspects of teamwork in Islam, we find that the idea of teaching and studying and learning and education is highly elaborated in the form of a kind of teamwork. Yes, in a school, in a teaching context, there are, for example, a few teachers with many, many students, but this can be regarded also as a kind of teamwork because the teacher tries to teach something, to teach some of his knowledge, if not all of his knowledge, some of his knowledge to those people, to the attendants, I mean, to the students. And in the Holy Quran, in the Surah At-Tawbah, verse 122, it's indicated, وَمَا كَانَ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ وَمَا كَانَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ لِيَنْفُرُوا كَافَّةً فَلَوْلَا نَفَرٌ مِّن كُلِّ فِرْقَةٍ مِّنْهُمْ طَائِفَةٌ لِيَتَفَقَّهُوا فِي الدِّينِ وَلِيُنذِرُوا قَوْمَهُمْ إِذَا رَجَعُوا إِلَيْهِمْ لَعَلَّهُمْ يَحْذَرُونَ. It implies that it isn't, it wouldn't be good that all believers would immigrate from one place to another place unless just some of them should emigrate from their place of residence to other places for receiving religious knowledge and coming back communities to their own original communities in order to guide them in matters pertaining to the Islamic religion. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah. Ala bi dhikrillah
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
English Radio.